So it turns out that Apple is starting with AI pretty modestly.
It's not going to get me to buy a phone.
All right, so level with us. How hard is it to make agents actually work?
I think control is going to be the key thing that makes or breaks autonomous agents.
I think there's going to be a lot more fraud coming.
Benchmarks are necessary. We need to all agree of a particular thing we're looking at. They are not sufficient.
All that and more on today's episode of Mixture of Experts. Hello, everybody. I'm Tim Huang, and I'm joined today, as I am every Friday, by a world-class panel of researchers, product leaders, and more to hash out the week's news in AI. Kate Soule is a program director for generative AI research. Hello, Kate. Marina Danilevsky is a senior research scientist. And Mai Murad is product manager, AI incubation. Okay, so as we usually do for Mixture of Experts, we're going to start with a quick round-the-horn question. And that question I want you all to answer is this. If you have an iPhone, will Siri ever be any good? Maya, what do you think? Yes or no?
I think so. I think Apple have a great track record at amazing user experiences. And I know they took their time with their AI, but I know it's for the benefit of how I interact with my phone.
Definitely. Marina?
Maybe. I still find myself fighting with Siri a whole lot and giving up on it most of the time. It's really great at reminders.
Yeah, for sure. And Kate, what do you think?
Yes, assuming they can get to the user customization.
Well, let's just get into it because our first story of the day is to talk a little bit about the Apple Intelligence updates of this week. Background is, of course, that there was a big WWDC announcement earlier in the year that announced kind of Apple's long-awaited drive into artificial intelligence. And, you know, this week we basically saw a slew of announcements continuing to hype Apple Intelligence, but in the context of the new iPhone 16. Release. And they really announced like a whole slew of things. I was looking at the blog posts, LLM assistance on text, image search, image generation, and to what we were just talking about, a Siri update. And I guess I kind of want to ask you just almost like to begin as like a user of all these products. Yeah, I mean, we were talking a little bit before the show, and it sounds like all of the panelists, myself also included, have an iPhone. And I guess, Marina, curious, are you excited about any of the features that are on its way? And if so, like why?
It's not really actually right now enough for me to go out and buy a new iPhone and try to get those features. The features that are there, while it's nice to have the LLM locally, and I always do like Apple's stance on privacy, I mean, what can they do? All right, we can rephrase text, we can summarize email, we can, I think, generate emojis, which would be really fun when texting my kids. None of it is still in that pleasure of breakthrough
stage. Like, I'm going to pay $1,000 now for a phone.
I'm not going to pay $1,000 for custom emojis. It's helpers, and the helpers are nice, and I'll appreciate it when I get it, but it's not enough for me to go, wow, this was something that was a game changer by Apple. At least that was what my feeling was.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the most interesting thing. There's almost like two points of view. One of them is like, Apple's getting it all wrong. Like, AI is the killer feature and it really will sell phones. The other one is like, they have it exactly right. Like, none of the AI features that are currently on the market are good enough to like motivate someone to actually buy a phone. Like, the software is not really pushing the hardware here.
Well, I mean, I think from my perspective, it's not going to get me to buy a phone. It's not something that's going to push the boundaries like significantly, but at least gives Apple an entry into what they've largely been kind of standing away from. So, you know, I think it's definitely helping them move in the right direction. Hopefully, like, I just don't even use Siri today because it's always like a 50-50 shot. Is Siri going to do
that? Yeah, I don't even use it either. It's like they're like pushing it. It's like the button and stuff, but I never touch it.
You just need to get to the point of like basic Siri usability. And I don't think you can get there without LLM. So, you know, I think they're making the right move from that call. And then later on, I think they have more opportunity once they lock that in to actually differentiate both hardware and software with AI.
Yeah, for sure. Maya, what do you think? I mean, I think, you know, one way of looking at some of this is that like Apple, I mean, they're a hardware company, right? So they're like very careful by nature because if you mess up hardware, you really mess it up. But are they maybe like too slow? Like by the time Apple gets all this stuff done, you know, it's going to be like OpenAI on the phone and Anthropic on the phone and Perplexity on the phone.
I think that's a good question. I think part of Apple's ethos and appeal, especially like when they started decades ago, is this focus on design and the user experience and doing less. They always did less compared to the competitors. So I think we're in the space where user experience matters. I think we're overloaded cognitively with too many things on our phones. I'm really excited about Siri being able to navigate different apps. So if they nail that, for me, that delivers tremendous value. And then I don't see them being in the hotspot to be able to respond to generative AI. They're not search. Their core is not search. They're not a chatbot in itself. They're a hardware. They're a way for me to communicate. A Siri is an add-on. So I don't think they're feeling the same pressure as some of the other tech players are.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting situation because I don't know. So the other week I was let's try out all these AI services. So I signed up for a bunch of subscriptions and the first month's bill just came in and I'm just well, this is really bad. But it kind of feels like maybe if Apple can release some of these features for free, it totally changes the economics of some of this stuff. Kay, I see you nodding.
Well, I was just wondering, Maya, if you had a perspective on does Apple have an advantage given that they are the integrator between all of these apps beyond what any one app like a Perplexity or Anthropic app that you could also install on your phone might have?
Yeah, I think absolutely. They own the ecosystem of apps, so they own that app store. And I think that would be if they could lower the barrier in the interface of connecting between different apps, that would be really interesting. And I wonder if in a year from now, if Apple will be the AI killer in the same way when OpenAI launches a new release and that kills a bunch of startups.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, I think one of the things I think a little bit about is there's been all these demos that have been floating around and I think they're often more impressive than they actually are in practice, but it's type what you want and a new app emerges. And it kind of feels like that sort of thing might eventually happen on Apple, but it also is this enormous threat to this whole edifice of the app store that they've constructed. So I don't know, navigating that I think is going to be really complex and challenging.
I think Maya brings up actually a really good point that they're more likely to gatekeep the app store until they've got their own integrations working, and then it'll be all about how seamless it is. Otherwise, if you're going to have different services having to try to talk to different apps, there's so much under the hood of trying to navigate different kinds of middleware that you'll have so many points of failure that people will be like, all right, well, look, the Apple version can't do maybe as much, but at least it works. And there seems to be a real opportunity potentially there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and it reminds me a little bit of, I know there was a debate many years ago about okay, how do we get this self-driving car thing to work?
They're always 5 years away.
It's always 5 years away, yeah. And I think one of the most interesting things was this debate over do we need to reconstruct the whole environment to make it simpler for the robot cars to work? Or do we just let the robot car roam and try to train it around all sorts of environments? And there's a similar thing here for agents, I guess, in the AI case for Apple, where it's they confront this very heterogeneous kind of situation for the App Store, which really prevents them from enforcing clean agent experiences. And it's well, I guess if anyone can do it, it's Apple because they have the most control, at least over the space. Well, that's a really good segue because I think, Maya, one of the reasons we were really excited to have you on the show was the second topic I wanted to touch on today, which is, I think literally in the last 10 episodes of Mixture of Experts, people have been and agents. Agents are on the way. Agents are going to be the new big thing. And we've kind of debated it back and forth and, you've actually been working on agents, right? And I feel so infrequently, the circle of people talking about agents and the people actually working on agents is a very different kind of delta. And you're pretty rare in that respect because I think you've been really in the trenches on it. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that work? I was curious both to learn a little bit about it and then what you're learning.
Yeah, of course. So I sit in a really interesting team in research. So my team focuses on incubating new technologies and opening up market opportunities for IBM. And we've been focusing on agents for several months now. So very much in the trenches. And one of the first things that we did this month is we open sourced a framework for building agentic applications. So still very early days, we did a silent drop, but we think we have some interesting features that we can offer in this place that reflect some of our learnings. And I don't know how much time we have, but there's a lot of things that we learned along the way. And I think it's very hard to bring agentic applications into production. And it's very easy to take it for granted. I think in terms of operational complexity, this is a step change from fixed flows. It's another paradigm. It's much harder than fixed flows in terms of implementation.
Yeah, we'd love to talk about learnings and we've got time for it. I mean, I feel like this is where Mixture of Experts can shine. Lots of people are talking about Apple. Let's talk about really building agents. I mean, maybe one way to cut through it is there something that you found surprisingly hard, right? Where you're before you went into it, you're we can nail that. It's no problem. And you're actually, this is really difficult.
So there's two things that they were a blind spot for us and we didn't expect how hard they would be. And then I think there's one thing that made us very clear of how do we bring this into production. So I'm just going to talk about it at the high level. First thing is an agent is underpinned by a prompt. So think of a set of instructions that tell it how to behave. So let's say you took and you built an agent around model A, and then you optimized it around model A. Now, if you want to bring it to model B, the whole thing breaks. And we had this experience firsthand. So we started dabbling with Llama 3. We moved to Llama 3.1, which we expected to be an incremental change, nothing much changed. The whole thing broke, took us 3 weeks to re-optimize everything under the hood, and we're still not fully there. So this, I think this is a bit critical because if you want to stay on top of the latest and the best models, you have all of this cost related to changing models. And that makes it really prohibitive to try new models. And I think this is pushing us in another direction where once you picked your model of choice and built something in production with it, it's going to be really hard for you to change model providers. And I don't know if I'm very happy with that being the status quo. So that's one part of it. And we have some ideas about how to overcome it. The other part is something actually we were discussing with Kate Soule this morning, which is we take for granted how to build with AI, meaning if I'm building traditional software engineering applications, I specify my features and then I code in my features and then I test my features and I'm done. With LLMs, I have features that I didn't maybe sign up for in the first place, maybe like outputting hate speech, maybe things that are useful like summarization.
Right, features.
Features that kind of come out of the box, but did I test for them? No, I kind of take them for granted. And I think we made the mistake initially of taking those features for granted and not following a test-driven approach. And I actually want to pass it over to Kate because she works a lot in prompt optimization. And I'm sure you've had your own struggles with this.
Yeah. Thanks, Maya. You know, I think one of the things that I found really interesting when we started to get into the weeds is how do you think about this kind of hierarchy of how a model or an agent is aligned? So there's all of the work that the model provider does in order to train it to be safe, make sure it's good at things like summarization and basic language tasks. And they have a perspective that they enforce on the model and how the model should behave in situations. Then you have the alignment preferences and priorities set by the agent builder. And so you have all of these behaviors about how the agent's supposed to behave, how this model with this system prompt together are now going to interact in this new agentic environment, what patterns are going to follow. And then there's even a third level, which is like when a user is interacting with the agent, I might have my own preferences on how I want the agent. And so this gets back to, for example, like Siri and the ability, does Apple have the ability to actually personalize to an individual user? Like as a user, I might want a very specific way of interacting with my agent. I want things to be short, always in bullets, versus I want, you know, everything to be in markdown format and much longer and, you know, have tables and everything else inserted where possible. So there's kind of these different tiers you have to start to account for when you're building models, and you have control over some parts. You can impact your system prompt design for the agent. You can try and create tools and different parameters that users can play with for impacting their own personalization and alignment of the agent. But then there's things you don't have control over that's defined by the model builder. And so, you know, I think that's where a lot of some of the interesting challenges come out of is trying to navigate kind of those different levels of control that you have and trying to work within the system that different model providers are setting up, particularly if you envision needing to ever be able to switch models to something new where different provider might have set a different process.
Yeah, it almost kind of presages, there's sort of this really interesting thing of like, kind of like legacy code or legacy models where, you know, like the intention will always be like, let's move to the next great capability model. But Maya, kind of the story that you're telling is like, it changes so much about the way the agent behaves that it's almost like you, in many cases, you may not want to because of the uncertainty or like in the very least, the kind of like evaluation burden of trying to figure out how to get that to work.
Well, one thought is here, the notion of backward compatibility is not something that exists in LLM. We haven't really thought about it that much. It has not been a thing. We know that that's a really, really big deal in everything having to do with software, the notion of backward compatibility. And did everything immediately break? And is that really all that useful? So if we're going to be really doing this seriously, I think you're going to have to start having to take that into account and have people create a whole new slew of benchmarks and functionalities and tests. And, oh, it was working this way before. How is it going to work if you're trying to plug it into something old? Another thing that I completely agree with what Kate was saying, that notion of control, Think about generative AI with art. You can give it a prompt to make a picture, but then you can't tell it, okay, I love it, but like just change that little thing over there to something else. It won't work. That's not how these models work. That's a real challenge that in software is like, all right, well, you did a lot of this right, but I need you to change this little bit to there and this little bit to there. It's not going to work like that at a very basic level. So both of these things, I think, are a very different way of looking at software building, and I think needs to be thought of very carefully to make sure that it's actually practical over time.
Marina, I was wondering if you had a perspective, like, does getting towards like GPT structured output start to solve some of the backwards compatibility? Like if we can now have greater structure on exactly how we prompt the model and exactly the outputs, does that start to solve some of the problem in your mind?
It's a step. I think that part of it certainly is the structure of the output, but another very large part of it is what are sort of the acceptable states and the constraints on what makes sense or not. Even if you have the structure, the content of that output could still theoretically kind of be anything. We're still talking strings or other primitives. And there's still a notion of what kind of states in your application as you're going through are okay and not okay, valid and invalid. In a deterministic flow, you write it all up and you know exactly what will and won't happen. You've got tests, you've got catchers, you've got things like that. How does that look here? That is, I think, the next thing that's on my mind.
Yeah, I think both of you raised a really great point, and I loved how much you spent time on speaking about control. I think control is going to be the key thing that makes or breaks autonomous agents. These things can run wild and have consequences that could be costly. So like we've seen firsthand how data that you might have thought as proprietary gets sent to an external tool and now goes to a third party, and maybe you didn't intend that in the first place. So one of my thoughts at the back of my head is I don't know if it's fully autonomous agents that will go into production this year, whereas it's more of a hybrid sort of compound AI system where some parts are agentic, meaning there's degrees of freedom that the LLM can take, and other parts are more prescriptive, are verifiers, are things that allow us to get the level of control we want. And I think that's some of the ideas we're starting to explore here, because I just don't think with the underlying models that we have, we can have autonomous agents, fully autonomous agents, safe in production. That's where I would put my money on right now.
Yeah, for sure. It almost kind of seems like we're going to enter an era of like almost like pseudo agents, where you have kind of like agent-y elements, but like actually is quite deterministic in some ways. And that actually could persist for a very long time. I don't know if ultimately your dream is, you know, the agent unshackled. But it kind of seems like the issues you're pointing out are very like pretty deep and categorical, right? I don't know if you'd agree with that.
Yeah, definitely not in the camp of agents and AI unshackled. I think AI has to serve us and fit
sure.
into our needs. And I think we need to understand how it works, and we need to make sure that it works in ways that is in accordance with our values. And I think that's the type of AI that I personally would prescribe and would align with my own worldview and values. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Well, before we move on to the next topic, I know Maya, you said you sort of soft launched this. Do you want to direct our listeners to it yet? Or is it still like you're just teasing it, it's going to come out soon?
So no, I can more than a teaser. So we launched it. It's a silent drop. We haven't shared it broadly.
Cool. This is the first moment you're sharing it.
Yeah, first moment I'm sharing this. So if you're listening to this, it's called the B Stack. And specifically, maybe we can drop the URL later. It's called the B Agent Framework. You can do some cool things out of the box with it right now. So you can already create an agent that can plan and use tools and maybe correct itself. So we have some use cases, but we also have exciting updates to bring. So one along the lines of solving for just the cost of switching models. I don't think we'll have the ultimate solution, but we want to reduce the friction of switching models. And we're working on bringing some of these enterprise controls that I've mentioned. And if there are people who are interested in joining in this journey, I'm very open to it. Still the very beginning steps, but I think we're excited about what we can learn.
And Maya, it's B as in the insect.
Yeah. Our team, like bees. Our team really likes naming things, puns. So bees as worker bees, and then maybe there's hives and all of that. So
to move us on to our next story, this week there was a New York City-based startup called HyperWrite that released a model called Reflection 70B. And it was kind of widely touted. The leader of the company came out saying that, you know, this model integrated this new method called reflection tuning. And this was the secret sauce that allowed this model to hit crazy good metrics on all the major benchmarks. There was a lot of hype about it, as most models kind of, you know, rising on the leaderboard get nowadays. And then immediately there was kind of a turn, where people said, wait a minute, we tried to reproduce some of these results and like this seems nowhere near what you're claiming. Furthermore, doing some digging, this seems like you just did some like bargain bin fine tuning on some open source models. And by now, in true kind of like Twitter-driven media cycle fashion, there's just been this big cycle of mutual recrimination and dispute. But the end result seems to be that we have gotten a startup that when on the publicly available benchmarks that everybody is using to evaluate model quality, and may have engaged at least in some shading of the numbers to make their model look better than it actually was. And I think that's so interesting just because like these leaderboards have become in some ways like the benchmark that we use to tell like who's actually advancing the state of the art and what models are good or what models are bad. And so I think the main thing I want to kind of raise, and Marino, maybe we'll toss it over to you first, is should we be worried that we're going to see more of this? Like it seems like the value of gaming these metrics is always rising. And so, you know, regardless of whether or not there was intentional fraud here, it seems like there's going to be a lot of bad incentives in the space soon, but I don't know if this is something you think we should care about or if this is just kind of what happens.
I mean, to some extent, this is kind of what happens, but I was actually really happy to see so many other folks jump on right away and say, no, I'm going to try to reproduce the results. You need to upload your weights. What about this? What about that? That is science acting correctly. Good science is supposed to be reproducible. And while it is possible to have something and have a hype cycle, it was really nice to see that there was immediate checking going on from, you know, third parties and everything else as quickly as it was. In previous years, decades, centuries, the cycles were very, very slow of what it took for other people to check their work. And it's certainly still the case maybe in other fields like biochem, things I don't know about. At least in our field, it's actually very easy to quickly start checking. So that was a nice thing to see. Another thing I'll say about benchmarks, and you know I can always go off about benchmarks, is they are a temporal proxy of a really specific slice of the world with a lot of things held constant. We are trying to check performance on a particular thing, and they're being artificially controlled. Are they useful? Absolutely. Are they sufficient? No. So we always like in science to talk about necessary and sufficient. Benchmarks are necessary. We need to all agree of a particular thing we're looking at. They are not sufficient, nor should they be. The whole point is you have a benchmark, then you have another one, you have another one, you have another one. We keep sort of, you know, check each other, keep each other honest and motivate each other to explore what are the holes, what is the next thing to look at, what is the next thing to look at. So actually, I found this to be a very satisfying.
Yeah, like the system is working, basically. Yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. And maybe, I mean, this is maybe another way at the problem. I mean, I remember going to NeurIPS a number of years ago, and there was a push a number of years ago to say, look, machine learning has this big reproducibility crisis. And if anything, this story is like, you know, almost the other direction. Like it actually turns out that it isn't reproducibility in the kind of academic sense, but we are seeing kind of like a emergent reproducibility happening in like the rough and tumble of Twitter or X. I guess, Kate, you're nodding. I don't know. Do you think like, is the problem solved for reproducibility? Like, are we kind of there? Or is this still kind of a persistent thing that we should worry about?
I mean, I think it's encouraging that we have such an active community focused, and I really like how Marina said it, on good science, right? Making sure that we check and validate. I think from my perspective, one of the bigger issues here isn't necessarily just the reproducibility aspect, but the transparency aspect. If we think of how this model was trained, how it's communicated. So, you know, we need to move as a field. And I think there's a lot of good actors here, but clearly there's some cases where we haven't quite got there yet, where it's not just a matter of dropping a benchmark. You have to be transparent and open about how, like good science also means sharing your methods and your approach and how it was trained and what it was trained on and, you know, getting into a lot more open detail where right now, you know, the norm is to kind of train these behind a black box, put an API out there and say, here, we did this really cool thing. Trust us, it works. Like, can you imagine that happening in like other products or industries?
Right. Like, it's like, here's an airplane.
Yeah. Trust us. We tested it. It's fine. You know, I think we need a lot more openness and just in general and how these are trained, because there's always going to be misaligned incentives when it comes to these benchmarks. They just get so much attraction and commentary that, you know, we need to have it always paired with a really open discourse of what was actually done and the ability to inspect what was actually done.
Yeah. And I think this seems to be the crux of it, right? Because I think, you know, benchmarks have almost represented like the compromise position for the field, right? Which is, okay, well, you have all these companies that have trade secrets and they want to kind of keep their innovations, like, you know, reflection tuning or whatever they want to do. And so we're like, okay, well, so long as you can kind of like show us your performance on the benchmarks, that's the transparency we're looking for. I guess, Kate, is just to kind of push you a little bit further on it, is it like you're almost saying that like we should actually expect more than just the benchmarks?
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of like transparency in name only, like companies saying, oh, we're going to publish a paper on this to follow, or here is a high level overview of what we did. But like, if you don't actually share the weights, share more details, like get really, you know, get into the weeds of exactly what was done. You know, a lot of this can just be kind of surface that, you know, you can talk about publicly as being transparent, but did you actually deliver details that have helped scientists reproduce what was done? You know, that is the level of transparency we need to drive to.
So I'm in the business of building AI applications for production. And so benchmarks is something we were just discussing this morning. For me, it's not useful to see a certain model's performance on a benchmark because there could be a number of things that are happening. It could be that the model has seen this data before. It could be that even though it does good on this, it might not generalize to my own use cases and what I care about. So my ethos around benchmarks is if there is a test data set that fits a feature that I'm trying to develop, maybe I'm trying to improve reasoning capabilities, maybe I'm trying to improve tool calling. There's a test data set that helps me identify my blind spots, I'm going to go all in for it, but it's so important. Like we're investing or building our own test cases and our own eval criteria because we have a very specific thing we're going after and nothing beats doing that. And even when selecting LLMs, I feel like benchmarks is nice to like maybe have a sub-selection of models to look at, but it's like Marina said, it's helpful, but not a complete signal.
Yeah, there's almost a kind of interesting phenomenon that I've been sort of chasing after is a little bit like the idea that, you know, it used to be that the limiting reagent was getting new models out, but then like models are everywhere now, right? And so it's almost like now the new limiting reagent is like a well-crafted eval or like a well-crafted benchmark set. And like that's increasingly becoming like where a lot of the bottleneck is, it feels like, in some of the workflows that you're seeing all over the place.
Well, and I wonder like as our models are across the board, you know, if you just look at the state of the field, models are getting better and better, being able to do what last year a model, you know, could do, but it needed to be 10 times bigger, you know. So these model performances are continuing to improve. You know, we're starting to get into the zone of, you know, is this becoming commoditized? And so therefore it's this race to the bottom, trying to inch up and get a 0.01, you know, percent increase in a metric that might not actually be informative of your use case because everyone's trying to, you know, show some level of differentiation. It's becoming increasingly more difficult as performance improves over the, you know, I'll call it like the workforce tasks that are kind of the bread and butter, low hanging fruit that pretty much any model can do now.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, sometimes I look at some of these benchmarks and I'm like, what are we doing here exactly? What are we spending time on? So at Mixture of Experts, we always try to do a paper as one of our stories. And I do want to end today with kind of focusing on a paper that just came out that I thought was pretty fascinating. It's entitled, Can LLMs Generate Novel Research Ideas? And this is almost a continuation of a paper that we talked about last week, which is about kind of using AI for science. And the big debate there was basically this kind of very interesting question of, can LLMs be creative, right? Can they become a partner that sort of like pushes us in new research directions that would have not gone on before? And this is particularly interesting because I think there's also a parallel discussion. Some of you may have seen this article by the sci-fi writer Ted Chiang that came out, I think about a month or so ago in The New Yorker, sort of arguing on the creative side, right? Like LLMs can't be creative in some ways because, you know, they just sort of don't make these kind of intentional choices about their outputs. And so anyways, I think to quickly sum up the paper, their argument is, look, we played around with LLMs. It does seem like they can generate kind of creative prompts. You know, their kind of spicy claim is sometimes even more creative prompts than humans themselves. You know, we should be really bullish, I think, on the promise of LLMs assisting research almost at the very, very beginning of the workflow, right? In the most kind of human part of the work. And I guess, you know, the first question is just like, do we buy it, right? I guess, Kate, maybe to start the story with you, because I think you've kind of come in as kind of the second commenter on a number of the stories. Do you buy this case? Like, do you buy this claim?
So I think the paper makes a lot of really interesting assessments of how a model can support research tasks. But what struck me the most about it is they had to search through like 4,000 plus examples to get 200 unique actual research topics in this paper. So while the models were pretty good at creating, I think specifically they're focused on novelty, on new ideas that, you know, the other human subjects that in this study hadn't thought of or come up with. You know, is it really that models are more creative, or we're just brute forcing able to automate searching through thousands and thousands of scenarios until we somehow, you know, get to the,
I too can roll dice until a unique number comes up.
Exactly. So, you know, that's where I think there's still some room left for debate on what does it mean to be creative or novel. And if did the humans get a fair shake of it, if you think of it from that term?
I guess, Marina, I think as like a researcher, you know, do you think this is the kind of tool you might be using in the future, or this is kind of still like mostly just game playing? Because I think, you know, Kay, if I can, maybe I'm being uncharitable to your position, but you're sort of like, this is just like a magic eight ball, right? Like, and, you know, if it generates something unique and great that inspires people, then awesome. But there's almost nothing sort of uniquely creative, I guess, is almost what you're saying.
I mean, I don't want to say a broken clock is correct twice a day, but like if you do something enough, you're going to stumble across something new. Does that actually mean something is more creative? And especially if you think about the New Yorker article that you brought up, Tim, where creativity is a choice. Like, are we actually saying models are more creative, or are they a tool where we can brute search through, you know, a larger number of ideas that are being randomly generated?
It's the second one to me, although that's valuable. That is very, very valuable. Absolutely. Creativity requires intent. There is no intent here. It's valuable because it can take humans a lot of times, and we come in with particular biases of how to think about things. Whereas if something is brought up to you, you can immediately say, oh, that makes no sense, versus, oh, I didn't think about it that way. That's valuable. But there's no judgment from these models. So I know that this has been used a lot recently in other science fields like medicine or chemical compounds, you know, where there's just like thousands and thousands and thousands. You can try to put them together, and humans just don't have the time. What's interesting is they are being used as a filter, as a brute force, and you get it down to this makes no sense, this is physically impossible, da da da. And then you start getting like a human intuition of like, well, based on my experience in the field for 20 years, this is an idea worth pursuing and this one is not. Can I tell you exactly why, to the extent that I can, like, you know, prompt an LM for it? No, but it's sort of a sum of my experiences. That kind of a progress, that's great. That's a very useful thing. But creativity means intent, and there is no intent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So you kind of buy the paper in some ways, I guess. Almost, is it a quibble almost about calling it creativity? Like, the problem is that, like, we're kind of giving it this word that has all this baggage, right? It's kind of on a pedestal, like the great creative artist, you know, the great creative scientist.
Anthropomorphic implications.
Yeah. And then the paper itself is not creative. Sorry. Because asking machine learning to help you, you know, go through a whole bunch of stuff and say which one of it is definitely not garbage, or here's some other things I've tried, that's not new. They're applying it maybe to this extremely specific use case. That's great. But that part to me is not new, while being useful.
Yeah, for sure. Maya, maybe I'll turn to you. I think, you know, all this conversation almost makes me think about like the debates we were having, you know, almost 10 years ago now about interpretability, right? Where people were like, you know, they're basically like, I think there's one line of debate, which is, well, you don't really want to use these systems if you don't understand how they do what they do. And then I think there's a certain group of machine learning like chauvinists that were basically like, well, if the model always succeeds at doing the task, what do you care about how it gets itself done? And I think there's almost like a similar bias when we start talking about like AIs and creativity, where we're like, we don't just want you to get to the right answer, but we want you to get to the right answer like in the right way. And I think what we mean by that in the creative context is like that we want somehow for it to be a little bit more than like a random number generator. I think I don't know if you fall on one side of that debate or another, where you're kind of like, actually it doesn't matter, right? Like if these tools help us get more creative results, then I'm happy. Versus like, no, part of our research agenda really should be to like kind of like get these systems to be capital C creative, right? Whatever that means, right? Seems to be a big question.
Yeah, I don't know if I have a blanket answer for this one, but it's context dependent. So I know in the arts world, source attribution is really important. A lot of artworks are done in the style of X known artist. How, like, there should be credit given to a certain artist in this place, and how do you give that credit? And we want to assign this characteristic to AI because we put social values regarding to IP, regarding to giving the right credit. So we want to align these AI systems to how our world functions and how we give credit where credit is due. So I think it depends really, like, what is the cost of not having that explainability baked in? Not just the explainability, but these other values that matter to us and that would make this technology align with our societies and not us having to adapt around it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that'll be sort of an interesting struggle, right? Because where some of this goes is like, oh, you know, model, you came up with like an intuitive, counterintuitive, very creative result. Like, can you explain why that's the case or how you reach that result, right? Like that kind of interpretability, which starts to look a little bit more like chain of thought-y.
I think we're just giving too much credit for these systems. Like the paper that we talked about and generating novel ideas. Well, first of all, what do you mean by novelty? And is it just like something net new? Is that something net useful? And it's like how these system works is just like the statistical probability of the next word. So for us, when we're coming up with novel ideas, there's meaning and value intent behind it, right? I'm trying to put an idea that maybe I care about, I want to push forward. So it's really tough to equate these two and put them on the same standing. One can be a tool for the other to maybe give you an idea that maybe you didn't think about, but I don't think one replaces the other.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's also like, and this also plays into this very interesting kind of like debate, which is like, they're just stochastic parrots. And then people being like, no, they're more than stochastic parrots. But I think, Maya, you're almost outlining like a third path, which is, yeah, they're stochastic parrots, but like, that's really powerful, actually. Like, you know, like, let's not downplay that too much. Like, the stochastic parrot is actually like incredibly useful in certain domains. And like, we almost shouldn't sell that short, right? Like, as a little bit of what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of the, this whole industry of generative AI was unlocked on how good these stochastic parrots were. And I read that initial paper that came out, but I think what took us all back was actually this can have really useful applications if implemented in the right way. But it doesn't mean that it can inherently assign reason and intent that we're not like, I don't think there's a world where we're there.
Well, so Marina, I'll let you have the last word. In 4 or 5 years, are you going to have an LLM co-author on a paper, or is this like still total pipe dream?
No, and I don't think that that's the right aim in that sense. I don't think I'm going to have that co-author, but it could be very much that. And we're actually asked to, when we publish now, to say whether you've used AI in your work or anything of that kind. LLM's helping you sift through the related work. LLM's helping you, you know, manage your bibliography and figure out things that are similar and different and things of that kind. Sure. But, you know, also to go with what Maya and Kate were saying again about intent. That's not what technology is able to do. Intent is something that you get from beings that are alive, that beings that are actually able to give that. You can have, that's why you can't have actual art. I agree with Ted Chiang very strongly. You're not going to have AI art. Art moves us because of the intent behind the person that made it, whether it was actually originally their intent or not, doesn't matter. You know that that's what that was versus AI art. Now you can actually feel again the care and the intent behind the people who made the LLM. Think about how much, you know, effort we all pour into making something that is useful. It's not the technology itself, though. It's the people that are trying to create something that is intended to be used and helpful and efficient and effective. That's where the intent is, not the tech itself.
That's great. Yeah, I'm applauding. So, Maya, Kate, Marina, in a nightmare landscape of jargon and hype, this panel is just like a light in the darkness. So I appreciate you all taking the time this morning to stop by a mixture of experts, and hopefully we'll have you on at some point in the future. And for all you listeners out there, if you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we will see you next week on Mixture of Experts.